Chapter 62. Topic of a certain large steamer making the same run, which was lost at sea, and never heard of more. Everybody has seemed under a spell, compelling approach to the threshold of the grim subject, stoppage, discomfiture, and pretense of never having been near it. The boatswain's whistle sounds. A change in the wind, hoarse orders issuing, and the watch very busy. Sails come crashing home overhead, ropes that seem all knot, ditto. Every man engaged appears to have 20 feet, with 20 times the average amount of stamping power in each. Gradually the noise slackens, the hoarse cries die away, the boatswain's whistle softens into the soothing and contented notes, which rather reluctantly admit that the job is done for the time, and the voice sets in again. Thus come unintelligible dreams of uphill and down, and swinging and swaying, until consciousness revives of atmospherical winds or soap and bilge water, and the voice announces that the giant has come for the water cure again. Such were my fanciful reminiscences as I lay, part of that day, in the Bay of New York, oh. Also as we passed clear of the Narrows, and got out to sea, also in many an idle hour at sea in sunny weather. At length the observations and computations showed that we should make the coast of Ireland tonight. So I stood watch on deck all night tonight to see how we made the coast of Ireland. Very dark, and the sea most brilliantly phosphorescent. Great way on the ship, and double lookout kept. Vigilant captain on the bridge, vigilant first officer looking over the port side. Vigilant second officer standing by the quartermaster at the compass. Vigilant third officer posted at the stern rail with a lantern. No passengers on the quiet decks, but expectation everywhere nevertheless. The two men at the wheel very steady, very serious, and very prompt to answer orders. An order issued sharply now and then, and echoed back. Otherwise the night dragged slowly, silently, with no change. All of a sudden, at the blank hour of 2 in the morning, a vague movement of relief from a long strain expresses itself in all hands. The third officer's lantern tinkles, and he fires a rocket, and another rocket. A sullen solitary light is pointed out to me in the black sky yonder. A change is expected in the light, but none takes place. Give them 2 more rockets, Mr. Vigilant. Apostrophe 2 more, and a blue light burnt. All eyes watch the light again. At last a little toy skyrocket is flashed up from it, and, even as that small streak in the darkness dies away, we are telegraphed to Queenstown, Liverpool, and London, and back again under the ocean to America. Then up come the half-dozen passengers who are going ashore at Queenstown, and up comes the mail agent in charge of the bags, and up come the men who are to carry the bags into the mail tender that will come off for them out of the harbor. Lamps and lanterns gleam here and there about the decks, and impeding bulks are knocked away with handspikes, and the portside bulwark, barren but a moment ago, bursts into a crop of heads of seamen, stewards, and engineers. The light begins to be gained upon, begins to be alongside, begins to be left astern. More rockets, and, between us and the land, steams beautifully the Inman steamship City of Paris, for New York, outward bound. We observe with complacency that the wind is dead against her, it being with us, and that she rolls and pitches. The sickest passenger on board is the most delighted by this circumstance. Time rushes by as we rush on, and now we see the light in Queenstown Harbor, and now the lights of the mail tender coming out to us. What vagaries the mail tender performs on the way, in every point of the compass, especially in those where she has no business, and why she performs them, heaven only knows. At length she is seen plunging within a cable's length of our port broadside, and is being roared at through our speaking trumpets to do this thing, and not to do that, and to stand by the other, as if she were a very demented tender indeed. Then, we slacken in amidst a deafening roar of steam, this much abused tender is made fast to us by hawsers, and the men in readiness carry the backs aboard, and return for more, bending under their burdens, and looking just like the pasteboard figures of the miller, and his men in the theater of our boyhood, and comporting themselves almost as unsteadily. All the while the unfortunate tender plunges high and low, and is roared at. Then the Queenstown passengers are put on board of her, with infinite plunging and roaring, and the tender gets heaved up on the sea to that surprising extent, that she looks within an ace of washing aboard of us, high and dry. Roared at with contumely to the last, this wretched tender is at length let go, with a final plunge of great ignominy, and falls spinning into our wake. The voice of conscience resumed its dominion as the day climbed up the sky, and kept by all of us passengers into port, kept by us as we passed other lighthouses, and dangerous islands off the coast, where some of the officers, with whom I stood my watch, had gone ashore in sailing ships in fogs, and of which by that token they seemed to have quite an affectionate remembrance, and past the Welsh coast, and past the Cheshire coast, and past everything, and everywhere lying between our ship and her own special dock in the Mersey. Off which, at last, at 9 o'clock, on a fair evening early in May, we stopped, and the voice ceased. A very curious sensation, not unlike having my own ears stopped, ensued upon that silence, and it was with a no less curious sensation that I went over the side of the good Cunard ship Russia, whom prosperity attend through all her voyages, and surveyed the outer hull of the gracious monster that the voice had inhabited. So, perhaps, shall we all, in the spirit, one day survey the frame that held the busier voice from which my vagrant fancy derived this similitude. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.